Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see $100,000, $600,000
deducted. So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here. Oh, man. He said, this woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man. Let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for two straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes. I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it had, was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, oh, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Adam Clayton Powell, for the first time, was defeated. Charles Rangel won in a very close election. Within a few years, Adam Clayton Powell would contract cancer and die.
If we must die, let us not die like hogs, penned in some inglorious spot. What use is an extra year or two to the man who kills the time that God has given him?
Much of the story of Adam Clayton Powell is on display here in this anteroom of the Abyssinia Baptist Church. But there are many parts of the Adam Powell story that you cannot see hanging up on the walls, mainly the ironies in his life. Isn't it ironic that Adam Powell was such a loud voice that few people would listen to? Perhaps if his loud voice had been heeded on the question of police corruption, there may not have been a Knapp Commission. If his loud voice about government corruption had been heeded, there may not have been a Watergate. If his loud voice against hypocrisy on Capitol Hill had been heeded, perhaps Wayne Hayes and Tom Dodd and Earl Butz and Carl Albert and countless others might have not have been caught in such embarrassing situations. Adam Clayton Powell represents still another chapter in a long story of black militant fighters against oppression and injustice here in America. He wasn't perfect. He had his faults, but don't we all? The point is, he was a fighter. If he did play, he worked harder than he played. Most of all, he was a fighter.
As I know here, you're in trouble, where it says about 30% are unemployed. That's why I'm working hard to get this surplus food here. Some of you say to me, well, I'm not like you. I'm not a congressman. I haven't got education. I haven't got work. But you're a human being. And you know what you've got? You've got in your hand the power to use your vote and to use even those few cents you get from welfare to spend them only where you want to spend them. A young slave boy stood one day before the greatest ruler of his day. And God said to Moses, what's in your hand? And Moses said, Lord, only I've got a stick, that's all. He said, well, let me use what's in your hand. And God used that slave boy with a stick in his hand to divide the Red Seas, march through a wilderness, bring water out of rocks, manna from heaven, and bring his people to freedom land. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? George Washington Carver, who was so frail that he was traded for a broken-down horse as a slave boy. And George Washington Carver, sitting in the science laboratory at Tuskegee, told me, he said, Dr. Powell, he said, I just go out on the field each morning at 5 o'clock, and I let God guide me. And I bring back these little things and work them over my laboratory. And that man did more to revolutionize the agricultural science of peanuts and of cotton and sweet potato than any other human being in the field of agricultural science. What's in your hand? Just let God use you, that's all. What's in your hand? I've got a string in my hand, that's all, and I'm flying a kite. And way up in the heavens, lightning strikes it. And I, Benjamin Franklin, discover for the first time the possibilities of electricity with a string in my hand. What's in your hand? Little hunchback sitting in a Roman jail. I haven't got anything in my hand but an old quill pen, but God says, write what I tell you to write. Paul wrote, I have run my race with patience. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. Henceforth, as laid up in you. What's in your hand, little boy? All I've got is a slingshot. And the enemies of my people are great and big and more numerous than we are. Well, little David, go down to the brook and pick out a few stones and come on back and close your eyes if you want to and pull back that slingshot and let it go. David killed the biggest enemy, the leader of the giants, against his people, and his people became free. Just
just letting God guide a stone in his hand. And a few years passed, and David is a king. And God says, what's in your hand? He said, I've got a harp in my hand. He said, well, David, play on your harp. And he played, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Leadeth me beside still waters. Yea, though I walk through the valley in the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? Man hanging on a cross? I've got two nails in my hand. Father, I stretch my hand to thee. No other help I know. If thou withdraw thyself from me, whither shall I go? And that man with two nails in his hand split history in half, B.C. and A.D. And what's in your hand tonight, people of Cambridge? You've got God in your hand, and he'll let you win because he's on your side and one with God. Always in the majority, so walk with him and talk with him and work with him and stick together and fight together, and with God's hand in your hand, the victory will be accomplished here sooner than you dreamed, sooner than you hoped, sooner than you prayed for, sooner than you imagined. Good night and God bless you.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that wealth is not money, and money's not wealth. Real estate's not wealth either. Neither is gold or silver. What is wealth? I believe that wealth is one thing. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. That's what wealth is. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. And so the more we develop our ability to create value for other people, the more wealthy we are. And the reason I say money's not wealth, think about it like this. If you were stuck on a desert island and you had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, what would it be worth? Nothing. Right? If you're stranded there, nobody knows you're there, nobody can find you, all that money doesn't do you any good. If you're there with another person, and they have food, and you have water, and they have no water, and you have no food, then your water becomes your wealth because you can trade them some of your water for some of your food. Are y'all tracking? And so everything that we desire, we get by giving somebody else something they desire. The more value we create for other people, the more wealth we have. It's just that simple. Now, money is one of the stores of value. That's what money is. Money is a store of value, and it's also a way to transfer value. It's also a way to represent value that you've already created, right? So if you think about money as like a certification, right? Like it's a certificate that proves that you've created value for someone other than yourself, right? And so, like, if you go to Eddie V's, and you're a nice person, right? And you say, well, I would like for y'all to serve me some food. They are going to say, okay, we'll serve you some food, but at the end, they expect you to produce proof that you serve somebody other than you. And that proof shows up in the way of money, right? Because that's all money does. Money shows people that you deserve to have somebody create value for you because you can prove you created value for someone else, right? And here's what's really cool. All of us are good at different things. So we all have different value that we can create for other people. And if we keep the value that we create to ourselves, it doesn't really do us that much good. But if we spread the value, the value that we create for other people, if we spread that around, then it becomes more valuable. Now, here's what's really interesting. I can't create value for someone until I know what's valuable to that someone. So wealth creation has, like, a lot to do with discovery, like discovering what other people value. And if I'm going to know what other people value, then I got to know where do those values come from? Like, where do values come from? There are things you value that I don't value. There are things I value that you don't value, right? And there are things that we both value, but you might value more than me or I might value more than you. Huh. So where do our values come from? Okay, I believe the first place that values come from is past, perceived, I'm just going to do PERC, perceived voids create present pursued values. Are y'all tracking? Past perceived voids create present pursued values. What does that mean? That means if I feel like something was missing in the past, I will work in the present to fill the void that I had in the past, right? So that's why if people grow up in a place where they're in, like, dire hunger conditions or feast or famine, they value food, like, at a very high level, right? That's why people so for me, like, I like cars. I like them. I like cars. I grew up working on cars, right? But I grew up in a family where when I was growing up, my parents never bought a new car ever. They had seven boys. Here's what boys do. They eat you out of house and home, right? Boys can just, it's like they're a bottomless food pit, right? And I can remember, like, if I was in elementary school, if I was going to eat a sandwich, I wouldn't eat a sandwich. I'd eat two, three, or four sandwiches, right? So, but I like cars. And so we grew up with buying $50 cars, $100 cars, and then working on them and driving them until they broke down. Then we go buy another $50 car, $100 car, and we had no car payments, right? So I like cars. I used to see people with nice cars. I'm like, why do they have nice cars? We don't have nice cars, right? So that's a past perceived void in my life, right? So it became a present pursued value. Some people are like, why do you have all these expensive cars? Well, expensive is a relative term anyway. I don't even, like, that's really relative. Like, it depends on, like, what is expensive to you, right? So, but the reason I, like, have a collection of, I say a collection, I've got some very nice cars is because I like cars, because that was, for me, a past perceived void. I work out. Why do I work out? Because in the past, I've been out of shape. And in the past, my body hurt. The more out of shape I was, the more my body hurt. So that's a past perceived void that created a present pursued value. Are y'all tracking? And so a lot of times we don't even know where these things that we value came from, right? I value entrepreneurship. Why? Because in the past I used to have jobs. And they always came with a boss. And I don't know. The word boss means, like, they're going to be bossing me around. That's what, like, they're going to tell me, like, can I go? No. And I can't even finish the question, right? Can I have? No. And I don't like to have to ask for permission. I don't like permission. In fact, the best way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't do it. I'm that dude, okay? I know none of you entrepreneurs are that way, right? So you started business because you love people telling you what to do. Okay. Judgment-free zone. And so I like autonomy. My parents, great parents, they weren't perfect parents by any stretch of imagination, which is why I did not become a perfect parent. Okay, so but they were great parents for me and my brothers, right? And they were very authoritarian. Like it didn't matter if I was 7 or 17. Why? The answer was always going to be the same, because I said so. Right. So I liked autonomy. So when I wasn't at home, I didn't like teachers telling me what to do at school. I didn't like my parents telling me what to do at home. And then I got a job, and the boss wanted to tell me, and everybody wanted to tell me what to do. And I know it's my own little weirdness going on in my mind palace, but like you got yours, I got mine, and I don't like people telling me what to do. So I want to live as autonomous. Now, I want God to tell me what to do, but I don't like humans bossing me around, okay, because their motive is suspect. God's motive is not suspect, right? Right? And that's why I don't like it when people on my team call me, oh, this is my boss. I'm not your boss. I don't even like the word boss. I don't have an outfit that matches a boss. You don't have an outfit that matches a boss. So unless we're talking about business optimization success secrets from Boss Moves, then again, that's a different story. But not bossing people around. Anyway, so y'all get it. Past perceived voids create present pursued values. But also, the second place values come from is present, pursued. I don't think I spelled that right. Pursued victories create present pursued values. So present pursued victories, the things I'm working towards winning right now, will cause me to value that thing. And so I've got to value. I want to win. So because I want to win, okay, for instance, I'm going to put my son-in-law on blast. So my son-in-law, I mean, we're really, really close until we get on the golf course, and then we try to beat each other's brains out. It's great. Okay? So he wants to beat me really, really bad. I want to beat him really, really bad. And for a while, I just beat him all the time. And then, like, I lost my mojo, and then he beat me all the time, and he was sending his mom text messages like, there's a new sheriff in town, and then his mom would call me, and I'm like, is this really happening? Okay, cool. So I started working on my short game again, and so now it's like the last three tournaments we've had, we play three-round tournaments, and we have this trophy, and every time you win three rounds, you get to put your name on the trophy. Nope, it's not on the news, it's not on ESPN, nobody knows but us, but we relish this victory so much, right? And so what we do, because we both want to win, is we both spend time working on our game, because present pursued victories create present values. So the things that we felt like we're missing in the past, that creates value for us. The things that we're working on winning in the present, and then the last one, is future pursued, I think I spelled that right, I don't know, pursued visions create present perceived values. So what does that mean? That means I can see an outcome down the road that is worth sacrificing right now for, so I'll sacrifice the short term on the altar of the long term. I'll sacrifice, like, my pleasure right now because I've got this vision down the road, and I'll take some time off of playing golf, and I'll take some time off of practicing my guitar. I'll take some time off from something I want to do for me. Like, okay, give you for instance. I am a foodie. If I wanted to, I could easily weigh 400, 500, 600 pounds. It would be easy. Like, I like food. You say, what kind of food? Almost all kinds. I mean, I don't like pork, and I don't like shrimp, and I don't like yucky stuff. It's disgusting. But I like to eat. And the better it is, the more of it I like to eat. I'm just keeping it real. Like, brother man can throw it down. I can fling it down. Hear me when I tell you. Yeah, I mean, where are my foodies? Where are my foodies? Okay? But because I have this future vision, right? Like, I've got this future vision. I've got a granddaughter. She's 3. One of the highlights of my life, my entire existence on this planet as a human, was when I got to dance with my daughter at her wedding. That was a highlight for me. Okay? So, one of my future visions that I have is to dance with my granddaughter, not at her wedding, my 3-year-old granddaughter. She's not going to get married at 3. That's not what I mean. Like, my granddaughter who is 3, when she becomes an adult, one of my objectives is to dance with her at her wedding. Well, let's say she gets married when she's 21, like my daughter did. Okay? She'll be 4 in July, so that gives me 17 more years. Well, in 17 years, I'll be 79, right? You know what that tells me? That tells me, as much as I love food, and I do love it, I don't like it, y'all. Hear me when I tell you. If I'm going to eat something, I want it to taste. I don't even want to waste any time eating food that don't taste good. Okay, y'all tracking? Like, I'm the guy who, when I make spaghetti, I season the water I boil my noodles in. I'm that dude. Okay, how many of y'all tracking? Okay, now y'all know who y'all dealing with. Okay, so, just keeping it real. Okay, so, but because I want to dance with my granddaughter at her wedding, when she gets married, I don't eat food until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I drink water in the morning. And I have a window to eat between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. It opens at 1 with a protein shake. Then I'll eat some snacks in between, like some carrot chips or some celery or something good with some different whatever dip I decide. I'll mix some honey mustard and some ranch. And I know that's not healthy. I don't really care. This is my vision, y'all. You do you. I'm going to do me. Okay, I know that's not the healthiest thing in the world, but it's what I do right now. So if y'all want me to do better, pray for me. Okay, so. And then I'll eat dinner. So that's but I'm going to make sure my protein shake is really, really good. And I'm going to make sure my snacks are really, really good. And I'm going to make sure when I eat dinner, oh, look at him, is really, really good. Okay, so what am I telling you? I'm telling you my value comes from something that I desire that's way in the future, that I'm willing to sacrifice right now on, right? Too many people, they don't understand that today is yesterday's tomorrow. And they act as if the actions they take today have no consequences in the future. Right? And so the definition of sacrifice is to let go of something of a lower nature so you can take a hold of something of a higher nature. And the best way for us to live our lives, it's like it's been proven, it doesn't matter whether it's in finances, whether it's in health, whether it's in relationships, it doesn't matter what arena we're talking about. Sacrificing the short term on the altar of the long term always ends better than sacrificing the long term on the altar of the short term. It always does. It's just like a principle of life. Okay, so now I know when I'm looking at my particular marketplace in whatever particular niche I'm looking at, then I know what I have to do if I want to create wealth is I have to figure out how to help somebody fill their past perceived voids, or how to win their present pursued victories, or how to fulfill their future pursued visions. How many of y'all check? How many of y'all check it? Tracking. Okay? So now when I'm looking at somebody, I know what kind of value, how to discover what you value. Because you're going to value one of those three things. Whatever you're working on in your life is probably going to fit into one of those three categories. Now, wealth is the result of value creation. The better your ability to create value for someone other than yourself, the wealthier you are. And sometimes that'll show up as money. Sometimes it'll show up as real estate. Sometimes it'll show up as like hard assets like gold and silver. But or it'll show up as digital assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum. But at the end of the day, whatever you pay for with money that you earned by creating value for someone other than yourself. So the very act of entrepreneurship, by its very nature, has to be self-sacrificing if you're going to win as an entrepreneur. How many of y'all got it? Wave at me. Say, I got it. Wave at me. Okay, good. Cool. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at what God set up in Genesis chapter 1. And I call it the four levels of value. So because here's what y'all, like, here's one of the things I think we don't understand sometimes. All value is not created equally, right? What does that mean? All value is not created equally. So I can say, well, but I created this value. Yeah, but the problem is either you valued it or maybe one other person valued it. You wonder why, like if you're not doing well financially, I'm going to tell you why. Because the pool of people that you've decided to create value for is very small. Or the value that you've created for them, they value it at a very low level. Like it's not like a big deal, right? I'm going to pay more for a car than I am for a pair of shoes. Why? That's a bigger value. Why? It can take me farther faster than a pair of shoes, right? So watch this. So like even if I go to eat at Ocean Prime or I go to eat at Eddie V's and it costs $500 for dinner for like seven people or whatever, I value that more than I value the money, number one, but I also value it because it gives me the time that I want to spend or invest into the people that I care about the most, and I don't have to make the food. My wife doesn't have to make the food. My daughter doesn't have to make the food. My son, my son-in-law. We can just sit down. We can go to dinner. We can pay somebody. They make all the stuff. Like, we don't have to go in the kitchen and do anything. We don't even have to open the refrigerator. It's amazing. They just keep bringing it to you. And then you don't have to clean off the table. I mean, if you don't want to, you don't even have to put your own pepper on your food. They'll put the pepper on for you. This is amazing. And then when you get done, you don't have to clean the table off. You don't have to wash any dishes. You just leave. What? Sign me up right now. How many of y'all checking? Like, so we have to get to the place in our lives where we realize that all value is not created equally, right? So while I'm giving you things that are not created equally, let me give you something that is created equally. Because all value is not created equally, all no's are created equally, but all yeses are not. What do I mean all no's are created equally? If you do a presentation to a potential client who does not have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no, it feels the exact same as if you do a presentation to somebody who does have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no. A no is 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 a no. Does that make sense? But if you talk to somebody who does not have the ability to take advantage of your offer and you make an offer to that person and they say yes, that's very different than when you talk to a person who has the desire to take advantage of your offer and they say yes. They have the ability. One has the ability, one doesn't have the ability. Those are two very different yeses. All no's are created equally. All yeses are not. Why would you invest time talking to people who have neither the desire nor the willingness to buy your offer? That's why I don't do high pressure sales. I'm just not interested in it. I don't need your money. I don't want your money. And if I got to drag you in, I'm going to have to drag you around. We would all do better if we would just realize there are already thousands, potentially tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people in the world who would love to purchase the value that we create if they only knew we existed. And if that were really the case, then I would be better off to spend my time to make myself findable than I am trying to find somebody to sell something to. Is what I'm saying making sense? Okay, so all value is not created equally. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God gave us the four levels of value. The lowest level of value is implementation. Implementation, oh, by the way, let me say this. Wealth is, it's like the value we create for other people, but here's what you have to understand about wealth. Wealth is a spiritual result. What do I mean wealth is a spiritual result? Well, let me ask you a question. Is it more spiritual for you to think about you or for you to think about someone else? Which one? Someone else. It's more spiritual for you to think about solving the problems of someone other than you. Okay? So wealth is a spiritual result. By the way, wealth is also a spiritual result because creativity is spiritual, right? And so if you're going to create value for somebody, that's also spiritual. So watch this. So the lowest level of value is implementation. What do I mean? This is like if you're on this level of value, if you're creating value for other people at the implementation level, you have limited. Who's limited? Everybody tap yourself on the chest, say I have. You've limited your ability to earn. Why? Because you're only going to make somewhere between minimum wage and about $80,000 a year. Well, that sounds kind of painful. Why? Because you're using muscles, which are a physical resource, over time, which is a limited resource. So you're literally using a physical resource over a limited resource to produce an unlimited spiritual result. No wonder you're stuck. This is why I tell people. Now, if you just love mowing grass and you want to start a lawn care company, that's fine. You just love pressure washing, you want to start a pressure washing business, that's fine. You can make money and create a level of wealth, but a limited level of wealth with a pressure washing business. You can. Or a landscape business or a janitorial service. But here's the problem. You're anchoring your income generation to time and physical labor. That is always going to pay you at the lowest possible level. Why? Because muscles are a physical resource. Time is a limited resource. Wealth is an unlimited spiritual result. Okay, what's the next level? The next level is unification. Unification, on this level, you're going to make somewhere between $40,000 a year and maybe, if you're like at a Fortune 500, Fortune 100 company, you might make $250,000 a year. Well, that, how many of y'all know $40,000 to $250,000 is better than minimum wage to $80,000, right? That's a better window. But, I mean, do you really, and maybe you do, but do you really want a whole year to go by and you only make $250,000? I mean, that's a question we have to answer for ourselves. And for some people, the answer is like, man, if I had a year went by, I made $250,000, that's more than $20,000 a month. Sign me up right now. Okay, great. Sign you up right now, but probably not sign you up forever, right? Can I get a witness, right? Like, it's not a bad place to start, but it's not where we want to land, okay? What is this? This unification on this level, the resource we use on this level is our management skills. Managing people is a higher spiritual activity than doing the thing yourself. Are y'all tracking? That's why when people get into management, they make more. This person over here, they're making tacos at Taco Bell. They're making minimum wage. This person might be a mechanic working at a Rolls-Royce dealership or maybe a Mercedes dealership or BMW dealership. This person right here is managing Taco Bell. This person right here is a middle manager at Lockheed Martin. But the reality is, if some company is paying you $250,000 a year, they want you to know they own you. Am I telling the truth? They want you to know. They don't just want you to know they own you. They want you to know they know it. Right? And so, if that's what you desire, that's fine. But maybe there's a way to have a level of freedom beyond that. And I believe that wealth begins to be created above this line. Wealth begins on the level of communication. Communication, on the level of communication. Now, somebody said the quality of your life will be equal to the quality of your communication. Okay? So communication, the resource you use on this level is your mouth. Now, there's a caveat. You have to have a mouth. You have to be willing to learn to use it. To do what? Create messages that move the masses. It's amazing that this, all of this, is harder than this. But to become a person who's skilled at this is harder than just doing this. What do I mean? Some people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they don't have to develop a level of verbal diligence and verbal intelligence and verbal acuity. Right? I don't want to have to learn how to talk, so I'm just going to go ahead and keep on working my fingers to the bone. Well, that's one way to do it. Right? Okay. Well, so communication. On this level, low end, you should make at least $100,000 a year. If you can sell cars, you can make $100,000 a year selling cars, selling insurance. Right? Selling advertising, $100,000 a year. But on the high end, might make $100 million. Why? Because you're using your mouth to deliver value. Well, Myron, what do you mean $100,000? Like, you know who these people are? These people are salespeople, right? They're also authors. They write books. Like, our books probably make us $400,000 a year. Just books. I wrote them once, just get paid for them every day. What is it? It's a message communicated. It's like these words that came to my mind, and they actually came out of my mouth. Like, I communicated a message that makes me hundreds of... I communicated messages. One of the books I wrote in 2006. This is 2023. That's 17 years. This book has been making me money for 17 years. We sold over 160,000 copies of this one book. Now, who could write a book?
Sorry, people. I had my mic on my phone on mute. So I was giving a rant. Thank you, Willie, for letting me know you couldn't hear. All right. Let me go back for an abbreviated rant. We're doing what I call today a podcast stew. Yesterday we talked about, coffee, gave a partial history of coffee. So today our podcast is titled Valentine's Day Village and Negro Fort Florida. Now, and this comes as a result from yesterday's podcast on coffee, and then I had an offline conversations or two with people about ghost towns. So we're going to lead this back to what I call the working title of Valentine's Day Village. Now, and since it's Black History Month, okay, and we did bring up ghost towns, here in Florida, and Florida has a number of ghost towns, there is a ghost town here in the state called Negro Fort, Florida. Now, it's a ghost town now. The fort was established by Florida in 1816 was divided into two different political municipalities, geographical political areas. There was Spanish Florida. Matter of fact, let's see, Spanish Florida. And you can look this up on Wikipedia. Spanish Florida, according to Wikipedia, was the first major European land claim and attempted settlement in North America during the European Age of Discovery of what we now call the continental United States. La Florida formed part of the captaincy of the general of Cuba and the vice for Iran, New Spain. Anyway, so in the New Florida during this time was where Pensacola, the panhandle of Florida, that's where Spanish Florida was. Okay, it no longer exists. Matter of fact, Florida used to be divided into, I have a map here. There was West Florida. Man, that went all the way to Louisiana. And then there was East Florida. All right, now. So, Negro Fort, what do they have on here? It was part of Spanish Florida. I guess it would be located in then what was titled West Florida. Okay. Now, so let's see. All right, it was established by the British. It was a place where runaway or freed black slaves from the plantations in the American South used to experience of farming and animal husbandry, used to set up farms stretching for miles along the river. All right, so this is how they can get their own piece of the pie. When withdrawing in 1815 at the end of the war, the British commander, Edward Nichols, okay, ensured that the fort was left intact for the use of the Indians. Instead, it came into possession of a band of renegade Negroes. All right. It is the largest best-known instance before the American Civil War in which armed fugitive Africans, they were no longer enslaved, resisted European Americans who sought to return them to slavery. As much a much smaller example was Fort Mosey, which is near St. Augustine here in Florida. The fort was destroyed in 1816 when a hot cannonball landed in the magazine, arms magazine, destroying the fort. This action also sometimes referred to as the Battle of Negro Fort, the Battle of Prospect Bluff, or the Battle of African Fort. Let's see. And like I said, there's a whole Wikipedia on there. They give the construction of the fort. It was a refuge for fugitive slaves. Or a Fort Negro. Fort Negro, Florida. According to Wikipedia, was a fugitive slaves had been seeking refuge in Florida for generations, where they were well received by the Seminole Indians and treated as free by the Spaniards if they converted to Catholicism. The origins of the future railroad, underground railroad, are here. The Spaniards wanted to own their own Pensacola slaves, but as far as the American slaves, they did not much care for. In any event, they lacked the resources to find and recover them, at one point inviting the American slave owners to catch fugitive slaves themselves. Fugitive slaves continued to arrive seeking in Florida their freedom. They set up a network of farms along the river to keep them supplied. The Seminoles knew how to do this because the former African slaves who had learned on the plantation how to farm and care for domestic animals either taught them or did the farming for them or both. The Creeks, another Indian tribe, knew nothing of farming and were impoverished. Even Nichols commented on the number of starving, resourcefulless Creeks who were arriving from the challenge of feeding them. The Creeks had a champion Indian, Benjamin Hawkins, who tried to help them recover their lands. They had never been enslaved, thus They did not have to worry about being returned to slavery. They wanted to return the return of their lands taken or threatened by white settlers. Now, who's this guy, Benjamin? Benjamin Hawkins, 1754 to June 6, 1816, was an American planter, statesman, and U.S. Indian agent. Okay. Let's see. The fugitive slave situation became more serious as the news of a Negro fort or African fort with weapons spread through the southern United States. All right, Negro fort. So that, it's a ghost town. And let's see, aftermath. A large group of survivors, including blacks from the surrounding plantations who were not at the fort, took refuge further south in Angola, Florida. Man, I never even heard of that place. What is that? All right. Angola, Florida was a prosperous community of up to 750 Maroons. Now, Maroons, to get the definition of that, basically Maroons were escaped slaves that existed in Florida from 18. Now, all right, Angola, Florida, I'm taking for granted it is a goat. Well, hold, let me read the whole thing. It existed in 1812 until Florida became a U.S. territory in 1821, at which point it was destroyed. Okay. The location was along the Manatee River in Bradenton, Florida, near Manatee Mineral Springs. The exact location is expansive, ranging from where Bradenton River meets the Manatee River down to Sarasota Bay. Okay. So Angola, Florida, for all practical purposes, what's left of it is a ghost town. Fort Negro, Florida was a ghost town. And I have a list of ghost towns here in Florida. It's so many. Let me even attempt to count this. One, I'm going to stop at 50. Okay. One, two, right. And I'll name them. There was Zion, Florida, Zana, Florida, Yukon, Florida, Yamato Colony, Florida, Wisconsin, Florida, Wilson, Florida, Willow, Florida, West Tocoy, Florida, Welcome, Florida. Let me count this thing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50. I'm stopping at Sears, Florida. Now, they don't have a separate article at least linked in on this. There's easily over 100 ghost towns here in Florida. Now, I'm in Polk County, Florida. So let me pick one of the ghost towns, and I'll tell you where we're going with this, because this is Valentine's Day. In my attempt to make this podcast stew, okay, I'm looking for ghost towns here in Florida. Here's a ghost town here in Florida. It's called Brewster, Florida. So this is they have a Wikipedia page on it. Brewster, Florida, is a ghost town in Southwest Polk County. I'm in Polk County right here, right now. All right, 10 miles south of Mulberry. Mulberry, Florida, is about 15-minute drive from where I'm at right now. It is has an elevation of 143 feet above sea level. Okay. It has been uninhabited since the early 1960s. The population, according to the 2010 Census Bureau on the census, is three people. So they consider it a ghost town, yet three people live there. I don't know if they're still there, but and they do have a picture of a Brewster power plant, but that's based from 1920. Okay. The village of Brewster was founded in 1910, and for decades, Brewster, Florida, let me look, how far is that from where I'm at right now? Because we're in the same county. Okay, Brewster, Florida. And this is an exercise, folks, that you look up ghost towns for your state. And information will pop up and count how many ghost towns are in your state, wherever you are. All right, Brewster, Florida. Okay, how far is that from where I'm at? Right, because we're in the same county. How long would it take me to get there? Okay, because I live in a big county. Polk County is big. All right, so I'm looking at a map from where I'm at in Lakeland to Brewster County, Brewster, Florida, is 20.4 miles away from me. So 20 miles away from me. And driving, it would take me 38 minutes to get there from where I'm at right now. Okay. If I walked, it'll take me 7.5 hours. If I took a bike, an hour and 54, but anyway, I got access to a car. So 38 minutes. 38 minutes from where I'm sitting right now is a ghost town. Now, let me go back to, because I'm going to attempt to segue this from the method to my madness on this podcast Stu we're doing today. Okay, hold it. Let's go back to Brewster, Florida. All right, so we know it's a 2000. It's a ghost town, but they did use the word village, and for the 2010 census, there were three people living there. I'm going through there one day soon. Just on GP. I want to check it out. All right, so Brewster, Florida, let's go back to what they have on Wikipedia. Okay. Now, it was founded in 1910, and for decades it flourished from, they used to be big in phosphate mining there. It was largely, all right, Brewster, Florida was a company town for the company American Cinnamide. American Cinnamide Company was an American manufacturing conglomerate and began as a fertilizing company and added many additional lines of business before merging with American Home Products in 1994. The combined company sold off most of its divisions and adopted the name name of its remaining wife division, which was bought by Pfizer in 2009, becoming defunct as a separate concern. Okay, so Brewster, Florida was a company town. That was the originality of it. All right, the town had its own schools, movie theater, medical clinic, post office, which was established in 1913 and discontinued in 1961. The inventor of the digital computer, that's a whole other thing. All right, they have they got some pictures here. All right. The Village was officially closed by the company in 1962. Much of Brewster was demolished at the time, but some abandoned buildings remain, including the smokestack, which rises predominantly in the area of the landmark. As a landmark. The deed to Brewster was turned over to the state of Florida in partial payment of a judgment against the American for environmental damages. Okay. And let's see, they have Brewster. Okay, so I brought this up because, and whatever state that you live in, once again, look up, just type in any search engine, ghost towns in wherever you live, California, Maine, Alaska, and just see what comes up. Because if you can, drive to these places, and if there's nobody living there, of course, now, find out the history as much as you can, because in some of these towns that are ghost towns, there are environmental concerns. So you might not want to deal with them. But in other cases, the environment's good. And it became a ghost town mainly because maybe at one time it was a company town, and when that business shut down or expanded to another place, because Brewster, as it stated in the Wikipedia article, they had a medical clinic there, they had schools there, it was a company town. So people worked in Brewster at the Falls Trade Farm, and then they had their homes there, and they can raise a family there. So there's a bunch of towns like that all over the United States. So now that's where we come to Valentine's Day Village. Today is Valentine's Day, and somebody asked me, was I doing a broadcast on Valentine's Day? And I thought about it. In the 10 years I've been doing this, I haven't done one podcast on Valentine's Day. Now, we've aired on Valentine's Day, but we've never done one specifically for Valentine's Day. So I figured, okay, we got a little bit of land here, so we're going to take maybe about a quarter acre of the land that we already have and crank up, this is just a working title, Valentine's Day Village, set to open February the 14th, 2025. That gives us a year. And I'm going to copy off of Luckenbach, Texas. Luckenbach, Texas is about, 10 acres big, and I think no more than 9 or 10 people live in Luckenbach, Texas, and but the town has a thriving business. They do a lot of entertainment there. You can rent the town for your special events. You can have weddings there, entertainment there, and somebody picks up their phone in Luckenbach, Texas, 7 days a week. So we're going to copy off of Luckenbach, Texas, for our Valentine's Day. So that's my podcast. So that's my attempt to throw in Valentine's Day, ghost towns, and, and then I don't know, maybe we might have a coffee tailgate or something. I don't know. But anyway, I'll get the ideas from you guys. Okay, wait a minute. Now, Let me extend the time here. We got about 30 more minutes. So, if for whatever state that you're in right now, take some time out right now and look up ghost towns in your particular neck of the woods or any state that you might be interested in, because if you go in with the right idea and the right team, you can resurrect that town. And let's see. Well, okay. We got that message. Okay. All right, we'll take a quick interlude. We'll be right back. Pick out a state. Let me think. What's a good state? I know there's an abundance of ghost towns here in Florida. Let me see. Let me think. You know what? Right above me is Georgia. So ghost towns. Ghost Towns, West Virginia. Now, let me go with that. Ghost Towns, West Virginia. Okay. List of ghost towns in West Virginia. Oh, Jesus, man, they got a whole bunch here. Camp, Sun, West Virginia, Sewell, West Virginia, Royal, West Virginia, Red Ass, West Virginia, Milburn, West Virginia. These are all ghost towns. Okay, let's look at, let me find something with a unique name here. And these would be great places where you can set up, what, tiny house villages. All right, let's go with Beartown, West Virginia. What's happening there? Beartown, West Virginia is an unincorporated community located in McDowell County, West Virginia. And, well, hell, they got listed as a ghost, well, as an unincorporated community. They don't have a population here. It's listed under ghost town, so we'll leave it at that. You know what, Alaska's popping up on my mind. Ghost towns, Alaska. Okay, list of ghost towns in Alaska. And what they have online, they'll tell you, it's an incomplete list, okay? Man, even Alaska's got a bunch of gold. And there was a gold, all right, well, York, West Virginia, no, Alaska, Tent City, Alaska. All right, let's go to Tent City, Alaska. Tent City, Alaska is an abandoned town except for a nearby military man radar station in the Nome census area. This is way up north. Okay, history. The tin ore was discovered on Cape Mountain as a mining camp was established at the base of the mountain in 1903. The Tin City Post Office was opened in 1904. In 1907, it had a few wildly scattered houses and two companies operating out of the village. The post office closed in 1909. And that's in the westernmost part of, what do you call it, Alaska. Okay, what else? Poor Man, Alaska. Let's see what that's about. Poor Man, Alaska is an unincorporated community in the Yukon, Koyukuk census area. Of the unorganized borough in the U.S. state of Alaska. It was founded as a gold mining camp in 1913. Poor Man possessed a post office from 1915 to 1932. Let's see, the community's name given for the nearby Poor Man Creek was officially decided by the board on geographic names in 1944. All right, that's a ghost town. Now, since it's Black History Month, probably the most Western black township, at least that I know about, was, and man, I want to make a field trip to this place one day, Dempsey, Alaska. Now I don't have it listed here on the ghost towns of Alaska. Let's see. Alaska got a bunch of ghost towns. All right, let's look up Dempsey, Alaska, and these are places. You know, because there's a lot of immigrants coming in the country right now. And basically, if you know how to organize people, you can bring some of these towns back to life. It seems like you need to have an economic engine in those places as well. Or where the world is now, just have a nice community and an internet connection, and you know you can roll from there. Dempsey, Alaska. Let's see. All right, Dempsey, Alaska. Now they give the coordinates of it. I don't know why they don't have it listed as a ghost town, but all right, to get the deal on Dempsey, Alaska, let's look up the person Melvin Dempsey. Okay, Melvin Dempsey. All right, Melvin Dempsey, and here's a picture of him online. Melvin Dempsey, the man, a man, his mind, and his mission. Okay, now let's see. Honoring Melvin Dempsey. Okay, part one. And here's a picture of Melvin online. All right. Let's see. This was written by Andrew Goldstein. In recognition of Black History Month, we'd like to honor one of the old Valdez fascinating and influential early residents, Melvin Dempsey. Melvin Dempsey was a prospector of African-American and Cherokee descent and was an educated man who remains an unsung hero in his accomplishments establishing the town's early infrastructure. Dempsey was born a slave in 1857 in North Carolina, the son of a Cherokee plantation owner and an African-American slave. He moved around in his early life, living in the Michigan towns of Allegan Holland, and Battle Creek. As a young adult, Dempsey moved to Colorado, where he became Deadwood's first barber. Colorado newspaper described him as one of the finest men in the hills and a model man. It was around this time that Dempsey established the interests which would influence his life in Alaska: politics, business, firefighting, ministry, and mining. Becoming involved in various mining interests in 1898, in the 1898 Klondike Rush, Dempsey turned his attention to Alaska. Arriving in Valdez in February of 1898 on the SS Alliance, Dempsey's family was religious, which may have gotten him involved in the Young People's Society Christian Endeavor, a non-denominational evangelical society founded in Portland, Maine. Okay, let me race along here. Let's see. Within his months of arrival in Valdez, this is in Alaska, Dempsey founded the Valdez branch of the Christian Endeavor Society and was appointed the town trustee. Among Dempsey's numerous accomplishments during his stay in Valdez was the founding of Alaska's first free reading room, founded by the Valdez First Society of Prevention of Cruelty of Animals. Okay. It also was a relief station for the Valdez Glacier and proprietorship of one of the town's first restaurants, which also outfitted prospectors heading over the glacier route. Let's see. In October of 1898, Dempsey was elected a marshal and justice and a member of both the town's volunteer fire department and Pioneers of Alaska. Okay, it was a relief station, as I mentioned that before. Dempsey's group, talk about tiny houses, Dempsey's group were a modest 10 by 12 huts located on the beach used as a debarkation point for prospectors and on the glacier's fifth bench with food, fuel, and bedding. Establishment of the relief stations was a townwide effort with contributions from corporations and the military. All right, so they had tiny houses then. or the Hutch, as they would call them.
Well, it's been
we
a great show.
Medical health.
It's been a great show you've been doing here, brother.
Yeah, so that's Dempsey, Alaska is, they give the coordinates, but that's some listed, some don't, but that's, anyway, but like I said, whatever state that you're in, just type in any search engine, ghost towns for Illinois, ghost towns for whatever state you're in, and because some, you know, they show up for various reasons. So, Chris, what's the news on your end?
Well, I've even had conversations this morning right there in Lakeland, Florida. There's a new clinic that is opening up in a town right close to Lakeland, a new health clinic, new doctor clinic.
Okay.
I got to meet the people that are actually opening up the free clinic. And their first things that they started talking about, and they didn't even know that's what I was on the phone about, was them having to send their homeless away to Lakeland or to other cities because they don't have anything to give a solution to. And they also would like to open up more of these free clinics in other communities across the nation, not just in Florida, but they are in Florida. So it kind of came into all of that a little bit, but I wound up meeting a gentleman that's working on a campaign for a congressman right there in Orlando in the 10th district there, Orange County, I believe, that is wanting to get boots on the ground, ain't worried about being elected to fix the problems and be involved in the problems, but the man's been to 131 different countries. And, I mean, he's met with, I'm wanting to say I heard Omar Gaddafi and Nelson Mandela was one. But, I mean, he has just met with anybody and everybody. He's just an amazing man. But he went there to see what the world was like, right, and to learn as much as he could. And now he's running for Congress. But he wants to get the homeless and the less – the people with not as many opportunities, some opportunities, open some doors. And so they're really interested in this 781 initiative. And we, I'd love to have him. I think I might have sent you a text about him.
He can come on tomorrow if he wants. Just let me know. Come on tomorrow if you'd like to.
Okay. Yeah. No, I'll send me a link for tomorrow and I'll share it just so they can share it out. Get a little bit of movement.
Now, what's he good at talking on? Because I can make the link geared towards that.
We're going to talk about the homeless problems in Orlando.
Okay.
And a way that we can kick off and solve them, and also anywhere else in Florida. But, he is a congressman for Florida, not just your district, you know.
Okay.
He can speak up all together. But, you know, we can talk about green energy, getting him, you know. We're needing to train our politicians, and not our politicians train us. And that's the problem we've got, you know, with everything that's going on in the world, right? So. Let's get him. He wants to get boots on the ground. He wants to get his hands dirty. He wants to fix this problem, and he ain't worried about being elected to do it. But I think he was already a senator. Dr. White is his name.
Okay.
I'd like to hear his take on, you know, I mean, he has been around the world, and he's been in the countries that these companies that I'm working with are already in, you know, and doing things. But he was able to go around and see some of these differences too. So just to see what his perspective is and what he thinks, you know, should be going on to support the people in the community, to get the people in the community right?
Right.
I usually don't talk politics, but at this point, when I got somebody that says they're ready to go get their hands dirty and start building something, and then when I told them about your 4 acres, not him, but I told them people with the doctor's office about the 4 acres, you know, right there, we could set up, you know, and have a community going and have 100 people living in that thing if it went down to it. But I know you didn't want to do that. But it's the point. They have a problem, and if and I think those people are ready to solve them. And like I said, they've stepped up with their own funding and their own situation just to give the people in the community an opportunity not to have to go to another city to get help. And even if they couldn't, if they didn't have insurance and they wasn't getting help, they could still get help. But
right. Okay, I'll just homelessness, we'll tackle that tomorrow. And matter of fact, wait a minute. Let's see. We got some time left here. We'll cover that tomorrow. And on that note, we'll sign off for today.
Let me have one more moment.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
My board and we actually were able to go to the property in Virginia. And I have a whole bunch of videos that I want to email to you so you can put them up on your Facebook page. It's got a beautiful gymnasium in it. It's got a cafeteria, and we got it's a beautiful place. And the property is amazing. Like I said, there's 1,000 acres there that we can really maybe open up a lot of doors for a lot of people to have places to go with their family, to do something to help other families, to help their family. You know, just our, I think the broadness of it is up to how much can we imagine and actually go and do and help people. You know, this thing has got land where you can't even see the other parts of the land because of the mountains. It's all through the Appalachian Mountains. It is beautiful. So there's a cabin there. I'm wanting to call it, as they called it, Big Bear Cabin or Lil Bear Cabin, because there's bears on the property too. But there's a lot of opportunity there for the future, and we have the rent paid for the next year on our lease part of one-third of the building, and we're there to collaborate. There's already a film crew and everything there, so things can be we're going to be constructing dormitories for the search and rescue teams from across the nation that are going to come there and get training, and I look forward to seeing what else we can do and offer it out here. You mentioned that West Virginia property. I'd like to know where that's at, that ghost town.
Oh, I just mentioned, I was there. Reading, I bought a West Virginia in terms of the number of ghost towns in that state.
Right.
Yeah, so there was no one particular, you know, I just rattled off some names.
Right, right. Well,
but there are ghost towns all over the place.
Friday, with a city in Mississippi called Friars Point, and I don't want them to turn into a ghost town. So we're bringing green energy solutions, housing, programs, education, and we introduced it to them, and it wasn't about necessarily trying to get in their wallet to do it. It was more educating the council. So we had a great meeting with it, and everything went well. They're looking forward to the the interactions here next month. We have another meeting next month, and also my Economic Development Council here in my city, Bloomington, Illinois, is wanting to meet on the 28th of this month and for us to give them some of our solutions. They're opening their eyes and broadening their minds. They got some new people in, and they like the fact that we bring in revenue to a community at no cost and no risk to a community. So,
Chris, let me ask you, what's your take on, you have a number of immigrants that are flowing into the country every day, which, you know, one of the basic things they're looking for would be affordable housing. So, which can be an opportunity for quite a number of people. What's your take on that as far as tapping into that market?
You know, it needs to be tapped into because, for one, these are human beings. If they're on the street, they're dangerous. If we don't train them to be a citizen of the United States, where they come from, rules are different. And that's, I think it's something we have to address because it's here. We can teach them to build their own homes, and a lot of them are skilled. They, you know, because all of our manufacturing left here, right? So
right.
We know that throughout the world, they are building everything that we're using. So their skills are, you know, probably better than most people's that, you know, are in America right now that are in a homeless situation. Because it's not that they wouldn't do, it's they couldn't do and they had to go. So I'm pretty sure that if you give them an option, they're going to go for it. But, you know, we can do this cheap. I've been sitting here breaking it down. I can build a 4,000 square foot building, the framework. Now I can have all the material laying there where we do a 781, if nothing else. But I can have all the material there for 20 grand. And if we put that on 1 acre of the 4 acres, we could turn that into a revenue stream at, say, $600 a bed per family and break them into units that sleep 4 to 6, and you know when you look at what it would cost for us to put the siding on it,
uh-huh.
and put the roof on it. Now we could put the roof on it and actually make it to where if we wanted we could expand and build up and make another, or make it a rooftop green house, that, you know, and give it that option later. I just build it with a flat roof, with floor joists and a drain system, that would drain water if it got up there. You know what I mean? But you could use it as a deck right now. And if nothing else, just, you know, having a building that size, You couldn't get the material to build a pole barn frame for that, and it ain't nowhere close to what this thing is. But I did a takeoff on a 4,000 square foot building, and I was amazed at my price, because that should cost about $80,000 to go buy it from Lowe's or Menards or Home Depot in a wood package, and it's going to be the National Blind Library in Jacksonville, Florida.
Okay.
They have a budget of $900,000 to build that building. I just told you what I could build the entire frame for. So you know as well as I do, that's not the... it ain't going to cost 900 grand to do it.
Right.
But it comes down to, you know, what is it going to be? Because this is just an opportunity for people that can't see to see. They can, and they don't even know that there is a blind library. So anybody out there listening, there is a Braille library for the blind, and it, and the people are amazing, and they need support. So they're having to move out of a mall that they're in, and the mall was sold, but the mall had some roof leaks, not in their section. All the books have been saved. Everything's been great, but they have to build this building, and they have to move out of the mall. So it's coming down to maybe if we could do one of our 781 build projects on this frame for the National Blind Library, and we give back to Jacksonville and the world, but we at the same time get some property to start fixing the problems that are on the street in Jacksonville, you know.
Right.
I'm looking for these jumpstart initiatives. I did get asked on Super Bowl Sunday to do the Super Bowl next year in New Orleans, and they want to you know, promote it all year long, so we could do 781 build projects all through those and have, you know, an amazing movement that would grow, because of course people come from all over the country to visit New Orleans and Gulfport and everywhere else. But yeah, it's the kind of things that I'm working on right now. I've been in meetings, you know, yesterday I think I spent about 12 hours in meetings. But every one of them have movement. They have people. They're on the ground. They're ready to go. I got 45 or 49 veteran 781s to build right there in Florida. I spoke to the guy yesterday. It was six people there and five people on the phone and three people sitting there in person. And these are projects they already have and they want to do. They're ready to, they asked me what it would take, and I told them, you know, $500 a day plus expenses. And they said, okay. So, you know, probably going to be trying to figure it out and get me to go look at the property and get things started on that end. But there's a lot of you that are already there. But we do have the opportunity to open some eyes there in Florida, maybe get a movement going here, start building hundreds of these houses, maybe thousands of them. All it takes is how many people, you know, when you look at Orlando, I don't know how many people are in Orlando or even in the vicinity of it, but I know there's more than 7, and there's more than 7,000, and there's more than 70,000. So if we looked at those multiples and seen what we could do from 7 to 700 and then take 700 and go to 7,000, I think we can make a difference and build 1,000 homes in a day.
Woo, so, man. Oh, let's put a pin in that one for a minute. 1,000 homes. Now, how many crews would you need for that? Like, for instance, like what's his name? Randy Jones, as you all know, he builds 3 to 5 tiny houses a day. And typically, he has a crew of 7 for each house. That's from, I mean, ground zero to a, whatever they, what time they start in the morning to the time they finish in the evening, a crew of 7. So if he does 5 in a day, well, if he does 3 in a day, that's what, 21. If he does 7 in a day, 7 times 5 is 30, a crew of 35, that's, you know, all 5 houses. So for 1,000 in a day, about how much manpower would you need for that?
We just need 7,000 people. 7 people, 8 hours, 1 house. 7,000 people, 8 hours, 7,000 houses.
Okay.
Or it'd be 1,000 houses, not 7,000 houses. 1,000 houses.
Right.
But 1,000 homes that, say, you know, brought in $600 a month to transition somebody from homelessness to this. They ran on a a 90-day program.
Uh-huh.
And in 90 days, we assess each of these people individually, and we get their ketones right, and we get, because that right there is one thing. You can take somebody that is an alcoholic, that is a drug addict, and if you give them a dose of ketones, in 30 minutes, their blood flow will increase by 50% or something like that, and their brain will actually be able to work better. And there's a that's the thing, you know. Let's go at this with a holistic, mental, physical approach, and stop talking about what is broken, and let's talk about how you fix what's broken by doing the things they're not doing, and just introducing these little things to the equation. It also brings in profit business, like the product. Now, the product that would be taken by these people, if a percentage of that product went toward this project, well, that would be a great thing. But it's not only these people that need to take it, because everybody needs their brain power up right now. And they need to realize that the things that are going on are trying to close it down and shut it down, and that's the stuff you're eating. So the healthier we can eat. You know, I was a meat and potato person. You couldn't get me to eat onions and green peppers and all that. And I eat that stuff now. And my palate changed and accepted it. My mental thoughts, because I couldn't even crunch into it. If it was crunchy and that, I couldn't eat it. But now, you know, if I eat a burger, I want onion on it. I never in my life, anybody that knows my wife sitting next to me, you know, 20 plus years now, and she's always heard me from day one say no onion on anything. And that changed because I'm using my mind to think about listening to others that have proven methods to get us straight. But, you know, I think we can do this. I think we need to really push the movement and utilize, you know, if nothing else, the NFL youth program. So introduce that to the kids that are already in these programs, not just the NFLs, but any youth program, the Boys and Girls Club, you know, any and every. And just ask them, say, hey, have you got a day out of the month? Or have you got a day out of the week? Every week, you know, and don't stop interacting with the kids, making them make it two and then make it three. But the point is getting them to do something every day. And it's not got to be build a house. You know all these other products. And doing these events with creating these live feeds on doing products, even if it's hats and stuff that the lady does, you know, sit there and watch your product be made the second you place the order. And then it gets put in a box and shipped. You know it's gone. It's going to be in your hands in a few days. So these are all little key components that we can show these kids that they can be entrepreneurs and have products and have money that will set them up for the future and get them educated on anything they want to be educated on and anything they don't know that they want to be educated on. But just kind of open up the doors a little bit on that. But thank you for letting me rant for a moment.
Oh, no problem at all. Let me see if marketing. Now, how would you attract let's scale that down. Instead of 1,000. Let's 10% that's 100. Larry, how would you go about attracting the manpower for, let's say, you want to organize, because with 100 people, you can organize several teams with that.
Okay, here's what I would do. All right, we want to build 100 houses. That means we need 700 people, or we need 350 people to agree to do 2 days. And to get 350 people, let's look at there in Orlando. How many different nonprofit organizations are in Orlando? I guarantee there's probably more than 50. It's probably in the 100 or maybe more.
Yeah, well, yeah, at least 50.
And then we
reach
out to them, and we see how many volunteers do they have that would be willing to change, you know, 100 to 200 people's lives. Or more, could be a little bigger house, don't have to just be a one person, two person, could be a three or four. It's just going to be minimalization living. You know, it's not about maximization right now, it's about the minimalization. Because right now they have nothing, but if they have something, it's a whole lot more than what they have. And the what else they can get is a way to get out of this and into something else if someone else get this.
Okay.
So,
all right, well, let's talk on it. I'm up here.
And also, if people would like to step out this Thursday, there is an open house in Orlando to show some of our models of the container home and the businesses that we've created. I was hoping that Anthony would join the call and be able to give you the full address, but if there's another number on here, it might be Chris. He might have the address that he could share with everybody. And I don't have the address of the event, but it is happening right there in Orlando on Thursday.
Okay. All right, well, boy, you're giving us enough content to carry on the rest of this week. So, I'm multitasking. All right, so let's pick up this with tomorrow. Go from there. On that note, everyone, because we're in overtime now, everyone have a good rest of the day.